On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Today's guest has a very interesting title of the book and a very interesting premise. The book is Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, an introduction to carnism. This is the 10th anniversary edition with a new afterword by Dr. Melanie Joy, who is a psychologist, international speaker, and best-selling author, the 8th recipient of the Ahimsa Award, which was previously given to Nelson Mandela and the Dalai Lama. She is also the founding president of Beyond Carnism. You can learn more about her at melaniejoy.org. Melanie, thank you very much for joining us today on the Bookshelf.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Now, there will be people, understand that we're in the Deep South. We're pretty much into eating all kinds of things, not just pigs, deer and so forth. When I first got the book, I thought, well, this will be interesting because I want to see what she has to say. And there are things that, even if we don't agree on everything, and even if the listeners don't necessarily agree with some of your conclusions, I think that a lot of what you're talking about in the book, it really has to do with respecting animals as a creation, not as equal to humans, but also not as equal to rocks, say.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, I think what I wanted to do was I didn't want to write a book about why people shouldn't eat animals. I wanted to write a book about why we do eat animals in the first place.
Right. And,
you know, really, why do we eat specifically certain types of animals? And my book is about psychology. I really believe that it's impossible to have a conversation, an objective conversation, where we can all learn and expand our understanding and make choices that reflect our own core values. It's impossible to have an objective conversation until we understand the mentality that causes us to think in a particular way. We kind of need to get out of this box that we're in to think more objectively about the issue, and then we can talk about it and come to our own conclusions.
Okay, that is fair enough. And I would say that to a certain extent, and this was me guessing before I ever read the first word of your book, that I would imagine that one reason that we eat certain animals and don't eat other animals has a lot to do with religious convictions, because there are certain religions that say they will not eat pigs. They will eat other things, but they will not eat pigs, and the Muslims and the Jews, for example. And so there are religious considerations, and of course, the Hindus don't eat cows. So there are dietary restrictions in a lot of the world religions, and I have the feeling that has something to do with why we make the decisions. And you incorporate that, you talk about that in the book, but you also go beyond cultural things to why is it that certain animals seem more appealing than others and so forth. So I don't want to steal your thunder. Go ahead and explain what you mean by there are certain animals that seem to be more acceptable than others, like dogs.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, exactly. So, the best way for me to explain this mentality of eating animals that I've been talking about, the mentality of meat, as it were, is to share a little bit of a thought experiment, right? So I'd like to imagine that you're biting into a juicy hamburger, and your dining companion turns to you and tells you that burger is not made from beef. It's made from golden retrievers. Now, chances are what you had just seen as food, you now see as a dead animal. What you had just felt was delicious, you now feel is disgusting. And rather than continuing to eat the hamburger, you probably want to throw it in the trash and maybe even take to the streets and protest. This is the mentality of meat that I'm talking about. This is what I call the carnistic mentality. We have been conditioned to see a certain type of animals, to think of some animals as edible. All other animals we don't think of as edible. Those animals that we have learned to see as edible, we feel disconnected from. We find the meat, eggs, and dairy that's procured from their body to be food. We don't even think about the choices that we're making when we choose to eat them, because these choices aren't even really visible to us. We just are doing what we've always done. So we're socialized or conditioned, basically, to disconnect from our authentic thoughts and feelings when it comes to the handful of animals that we've learned to classify as edible.
There are, of course, like I said, religious considerations in a lot of different, there in the Old Testament, for example, it has very strict dietary restrictions on certain kinds of animals that seem to be, upon investigation, animals that either eat carrion, which certainly would be kind of an icky thing, and also animals that are filter feeders. Again, the problem being hygiene as well as being prohibited by a higher being. The relationship between dogs and human beings has changed quite a bit over the centuries. Dogs, say, 2,000 years ago, were not seen as lovable pets. They were mostly seen as working animals, if people had them at all. They didn't think of them, but they still didn't eat them in Western cultures anyway.
Right, and your point is well taken. A lot of what we inherit, you know, the animals who we learn to classify as edible, we learn this from our culture. We learn this from our religion. We often assume that we eat certain animals but not others because of some rational basis. And there is some rational basis, right? For example, we typically don't eat carnivores because it's very expensive and difficult to raise and slaughter carnivores. They would fight each other. They would fight us. Right. They're more dangerous to consume, right? But there are a lot of, you know, irrationalities in our choices of which animals to eat. So, for example, Californians have snails in their backyards that are exactly the same kinds of snails as are classified as escargot in France.
Right.
But because they're in the backyards of Californians, they're not perceived as edible. In meat-eating cultures around the world, people learn to classify a small handful of animals as edible, and all the rest they learn to classify as inedible. And even though the species consumed changes from culture to culture, members of all cultures tend to find their own choices to be rational and the choices of other cultures to be irrational and disgusting and often even offensive. So what's really interesting is that the psychology of eating animals is consistent around cultures. And this is the psychology that's really the focus of my book. When we are born into a dominant, you know, a system that conditions us that eating animals or certain animals is the way that we're supposed to be, it's the way things are, it's the right way to be, we inevitably just, we learn to disconnect from our authentic thoughts and feelings. Most people never think about why they eat certain animals but not others, or why they eat any animals at all. And this has real consequences, because in just one day, more farmed animals are slaughtered globally than the total number of people killed in all wars throughout history. We also know that factory farming is, you know, in animal agriculture is a leading driver of environmental destruction. It's a leading driver of pandemics, and it's also a leading cause of human health problems. So there really are consequences to, you know, to eating animals. And so I really believe that people need and deserve to know the truth, not just the truth about the consequences of animal agriculture, but the truth about carnism. This is the invisible belief system that conditions us to eat certain animals. And it's so that we can make our food choices freely, because without awareness, there is no free choice.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Melanie Joy, who is the author of Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, An Introduction to Carnism. This is the 10th anniversary edition, and it's published by Red Wheel, and you can go to their website, Red Wheel Weiser, that's WEISER.com. You can also check out more information about Dr. Joy at MelanieJoy.org. One of the points that you make in the book is about the massive killing fields, basically, of cattle and so forth. And I will say that in this area, we still have mostly small family farms. My wife grew up on one, and they always had cows. They sometimes named the cows, and they didn't eat all of the cows. Sometimes they just like having cows kind of in the pasture. When they needed to have some food, then they would, say, choose one particular cow, usually a cow that was kind of ornery and not as nice as the other cows, to be honest. This is what she's told me. And they would put that cow in a separate place. It was already a grown cow. You're not taking away baby cows from mamas or anything like that, because people that work on a farm understand that even though cows aren't like people, nonetheless, they do have some emotions and they do have a maternal attachment. And because if you separate mama cows from little cows, they make noise all night. Eventually, they seem to get get past it because they, I can only assume that they think that the other one has died. But there's not the traumatic kind of a murder that you have on a mass sale that you have in a big slaughterhouse. And you give some pretty horrific examples of this, but it did not surprise me because I know that these gigantic feedlots run by Monsanto and places like that, and Armour and Hormel and so forth, it is pretty rugged, and as you point out, it's got to have an effect on the people whose job it is to kill the animals so that they can be processed as for meat or hide or whatever. For me, that's a big difference between animals that you raise on your own farm that you know that you care about, and animals that are just in part of a slaughter factory.
Well, yes, and you know, approximately 95% of the meat, eggs, and dairy that make it to the supermarkets and that make it to our plates do in fact come from animals who are raised in intensive confinement. So at this point in time, you know, almost anywhere you go in the world, certainly in the United States, if you're buying your animal products, your carnistic products from a grocery store, or you're going out to a restaurant, or you're ordering catering, you know, chances are very, very high that they did not come from a small family farm.
There are chicken houses around here, and I know that that is basically the kind of situation that you're writing about in Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, because they are even in family farms. The idea is how many can we cram into a certain size, and how many can we put into a cage on the way to a slaughterhouse. That's an unpleasant situation, that's for sure. But I have to ask this, what would we need chickens for if not for food? They're not really good for anything else. They don't eat enough bugs and stuff that more than, say, other birds. What would we do with chickens if they weren't food?
Well, we would stop breeding chickens in order to become food in the first place. So we wouldn't need to worry about what to do with chickens if we weren't breeding them.
Well, I understand what you're saying. We wouldn't need tens of thousands of chickens if we're not going to eat them. But still, what would be the role of a chicken in the environment if it was just left to be a free bird or something?
I'm not sure how to answer that question. My assumption is that we would no longer have domesticated chickens at all. So if we don't have domesticated chickens, then we wouldn't have to worry about finding a role for them or what their role would be in an environment, in the environment. Because this is what you're talking about, right? You're talking about domesticated chickens, which
right.
are chickens that people consume.
Right.
Right. So we wouldn't be domesticating in the first place, meaning that we wouldn't there wouldn't necessarily be a role for them because there wouldn't be there wouldn't be human consumption of them.
Okay.
Unless I'm missing something.
No. That's really what I'm asking. And I'm not asking in an accusatory manner. I'm just mm-hmm. asking like, well, okay, what do we do with them?
Yeah.
If we decided today that we were no longer going to eat eggs, say, and of course I have vegan friends and I have vegetarian friends and I know there's a difference, and some of them would never eat an egg because that's still an animal product, and they wouldn't. And some of them eat fish, but not vegans, but vegetarians sometimes eat fish, and that's kind of a slippery slope there, because it's still a critter, even if you catch it in your backyard pond. So really, what you're saying is that it would be better if people quit eating any sort of flesh whatsoever.
Well, what I'm saying is that I think people need and deserve to understand the psychological mechanisms, these psychological defense mechanisms, which I would love to talk about, which are the subject of my book, in order to be able to decide, you know, what kind of dietary lifestyle they want to follow. Most of us, you know, when I was growing up, I ate a lot of meat, eggs, and dairy. I was actually the meat lover's pizza girl. But nobody had ever asked me when I was younger if, you know, I wanted to eat animals or how I felt about eating animals or if I believed in eating animals. Eating animals, it was just a given.
Right.
It was just the way things are. And what I'm saying here is that, you know, it's really given the impact of our food choices on our own bodies. You know, eating animals has been, you know, connected with some of the leading, the most serious diseases in the Western world today, everything from heart disease to obesity to certain types of cancers, type 2 diabetes. I could go on and on. You know, the impact on the environment and certainly the impact on animals. we need and deserve to know the truth about this issue, about the impact of our food choices. And we can't have a conversation about that if we don't really understand how we've all been affected psychologically. And what I'm talking about here is, you know, what I found. I grew up, as I said, I grew up eating animals. I also grew up with a dog. And for much of my life, I never thought about how strange it was that I could pet my dog with one hand, you know, while I ate a pork chop with the other. I just didn't make the connection between the meat on my plate and the living being it once was. And, of course, some people do make that connection, as you point out. Some people raise and kill their own animals for food. But what we're talking about here is, the way in which, or what I'm talking about here, is the way in which we really learn to desensitize ourselves. Most people would be so deeply opposed to the way that animals are raised and slaughtered for food today, and most people would be opposed to any kind of slaughtering of animals if those animals were, for example, golden retrievers or certain types of cats, animals that we've learned to think of as companion animals that we still feel our natural empathy toward. Well, what happens... Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, of course, there are some animals that are more capable of being companions than others. I mean, I've never understood why people would want to have an anaconda for a pet either. I mean, a gigantic snake that could eat your other pets doesn't seem like a very companionable thing. And I don't think they're nearly as smart as a cat or a dog. And a chicken is smarter than we think, but it's still not as smart as a dog. So I think there are some animals that seem to be more reasonable that they're pets and not food. But you're right. I mean, that's a cultural thing too, isn't it? In the East,
it absolutely is.
You know,
it
in the East, is. Meat is meat, and of course, to be fair, we're sitting here in America where people have vast gastronomical choices. It's we don't want to say, well, for those people out there that are in the world that are starving to death, you shouldn't be eating a chicken. Who we're really talking to is the people like us that have options.
People like us who have options, and people who most people we know, and studies show this, that most of us share the same core human values, values of caring and fairness, compassion and fairness. Most people would never willingly support intensive and completely unnecessary violence toward other animals. Most people recognize that animals like pigs and chickens and cows have lives that matter to them. They bleed like you and I do. They scream out in pain like our dogs and cats might. Pigs are actually more intelligent, or as intelligent at least, as three-year-old children. Some people keep chickens as pets in this part of the world and in other parts of the world. Most people cringe when they're faced with images of animal suffering. And today, animal suffering is extensive and intensive and completely unnecessary at this point in time, at least for many people in the world today. And most people would withhold their support from this system if they were really aware of what was going on and of how they have been so conditioned to believe that eating animals is the way things are supposed to be. And, you know, let me give you an example and just a quick, actually, explanation of what I've been talking about here.
Okay.
with carnism. I've mentioned carnism a couple of times, and this is actually the subject of my book. I did my doctoral research on the psychology of violence and nonviolence, and I wrote my dissertation, my doctoral dissertation on the psychology of eating animals. And that was what led me to identify what I came to call carnism, which is the invisible belief system that conditions us to eat certain animals. We tend to assume that only vegans and vegetarians follow a belief system, but the only reason we might eat pigs but not dogs, for example, is because we do have a belief system when it comes to eating animals. But carnism is a special kind of belief system. It is a violent system. That means, you know, it's literally organized around violence. Meat cannot be produced without killing, and egg and dairy production today cause extensive harm to animals. And so because most people would not willingly support a system such as carnism needs to use psychological defense mechanisms, and this is what I found in my doctoral research. These are ways of thinking, essentially, psychological defense mechanisms that distort our perceptions of farmed animals and meat, eggs, and dairy so that we disconnect from our natural empathy for those animals. and act against our core values and our own interests, ultimately, and the interests of others without fully realizing what we're doing. So, for example, carnism teaches us to think of farmed animals as abstractions, as lacking any individuality or personality of their own. So we learn to believe that or feel that a pig is a pig and all pigs are the same. Or we look at the chicken on our plate and we refer to it as something rather than someone. So there's a whole host of various defense mechanisms that disconnect us from the truth of our experience when we're eating animals. And this carnism is so widespread that it's basically woven through the very structure of society. So when we study nutrition, for example, we're actually studying carnistic nutrition. We really need to understand this system so we can step outside of it and think for ourselves and make choices that reflect what we authentically think and feel rather than what we've been conditioned to think and feel.
So what if people think and feel and decide they still like the smell of a steak? I understand. I have friends who are vegans, like I said, and they're not mean about it. They don't lambaste those of us who eat meat, but they disagree with it, and I respect them for that. And I understand some of them. It's because it's they don't feel like it's healthy for them. I have a friend who's probably been a friend of mine for over 30 years, and she has always avoided meat because in her family, heart disease it runs rampant, and she figured not eating red meat would probably be a really smart thing. She misses it, but she feels like it's healthier. And then I have friends that say, I don't want to eat meat because I feel it's an animal that has a life, and I don't want to have to kill something for me to live. I understand that, too. So do we all need to go back to being vegetarians? We were that way according to the Bible. Everybody ate nothing but vegetables prior to the flood of Noah. So do we need to go back to that? Is that what you're hoping that we will come to an epiphany about?
Well, I think the first step is really, as I've been saying, is awareness. At my website at carnism.org, people can get a lot of information if they're interested in learning more about carnism and also about moving beyond carnism. So the first step is really learning and really becoming aware and, you know, really understanding what's going on, what's happening to the animals, to the environment, to your own psyche, because otherwise you're not making choices that are really you're not making informed choices. And, you know, if people want to, if there are people who are listening, for example, are thinking, well, hey, you know, I'd like to reduce my participation in this system. I want to reduce the harm that I'm contributing to. Don't think of this as, you know, all or nothing. It's not either you're vegan and you're part of the solution and you're not vegan and you're part of the problem. You can, you know, you can be as vegan as possible. What that means is just ask yourself, how many plant-based foods can I add to my diet? And they'll crowd out, you know, some of the animal-based foods. You can also use your influence to support the transformation of the system that is carnism, this violent system that is carnism, however you can do that. You know, you're a great example of this. You're not vegan, as you've said, but you're having a conversation that's helping other people learn about this issue and encouraging them to think and reflect upon their own choices. So you can use your influence to help in the transformation of the system without it having to be simply a matter of your own dietary choice.
Certainly, everybody over a certain age has probably been told by their doctor that you need to eat a lot more vegetables and a lot less hamburger, that's for sure. And maybe that's the beginning of awareness to think, well, gee, why is that? And what's the difference between the type of things that our body breaks down and how our body breaks them down that maybe certain foods would be healthier for you. And if they're healthier for you, then wouldn't they be healthier for other people? And if they are, how does that affect all of the systems that are in place in our country and around the world? We certainly, and I'll toss this in, we certainly have learned, immunologically speaking, that it's a really bad idea for people to eat things like monkeys and bats. Because no matter, even if we don't like bats and don't think monkeys are worthwhile, apparently eating monkeys and eating bats is what contributed somehow DNA-wise to AIDS and to coronaviruses. So obviously that was a decision that was not a very good one. Do you feel like that if people worked for more, if people worked for a more humane way of running the slaughterhouses, that'd be a step in the right direction?
I mean, I think reducing our support for carnism by adding more plant-based foods into our diet is a much simpler solution. It's much less messy, much less complicated, and again, it's much more in alignment with most people's values. Like I had mentioned, most people, you know, would consider it cruel to slaughter a happy, healthy golden retriever just because people like the way her thighs taste. So regardless as to how she was raised and regardless as to how she was killed. So I think it's really important just to keep coming back to this question. Like, if we wouldn't support this practice being done toward a dog or a cat, would we still, like, how do we feel about this? You know, this is what we need to keep on reflecting on. And, you know, change is slow. I just encourage people to, you know, we're talking about changing a pretty significant system. But the good news is that change is happening. I've been to over 50 countries on 6 continents, and everywhere I go, you know, from Kuwait to Taiwan, Latvia, Lithuania, I see and hear the same thing again and again and again. More and more people are withholding their support from this system that is carnism. More and more people are working to, you know, eat a more plant-based diet, and there's this incredible proliferation of plant-based eating everywhere, restaurants and organizations. Unfortunately, there's also a growing body of literature demonstrating the health benefits of eating a plant-based diet and also the dangers of, you know, eating an animal-based diet.
I just had this thought, and I don't mean this to be mean, and if this offends you, then I can edit it from this discussion, but I know people that eat alligator and rattlesnake because they're not very nice animals, and the meat works just fine, and they don't feel guilty about killing a rattlesnake and eating it. Of course, I don't really think there's any kind of a wholesale slaughter of snakes and alligators, so I don't know if that's really part of the issue or not, but or does that fall back into, well, we don't like to kill the nice animals, but it's okay to kill the stupid animals or the ugly animals?
I mean, it's a good question. We're more, it's easier for us to desensitize ourselves towards those animals we've learned to think of as bad in some way, as stupid, as ugly, as, you know, lazy, whatever it may be. And of course, there are always going to be people, you know, who are not uncomfortable with the act of killing animals and never would be. But people are very diverse. There are also people who would never be uncomfortable with other kinds of acts of harming humans, for example.
True that. There are certainly more pre-born infants that are killed in America than we'd ever like to think about. Comparisons to Nazi Germany is pretty a pretty scary and unwholesome thing to realize. I'm thinking that what we're really saying here is that don't just blindly eat what you've always eaten. Think about what the impact is on your body, what the impact is on the environment, and certainly think about the impact on the animals that we're consuming. Would that be fair?
That would be fair, and really not just think about it, but learn about it. Get informed. Get informed so that you're aware. And then you can make choices that reflect, you know, your values. And most people want to live a life of integrity, but we can't live a life of integrity, meaning a life in alignment with our values, if we don't have the information about the impact of our food choices.
Dr. Melanie Joy has been our guest today. Her book, which is the 10th anniversary edition of Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, An Introduction to Carnism. It's from Red Wheel Publishing. You can check, once again, their website, Redwheel, WEISER.com. And you can check Melanie's website at melaniejoy.org. Thank you very much for the book and the opportunity to have a conversation about this.
Great. It's been a pleasure. And if people want more information about carnism, and they can also access the book there, they can go to carnism.org.
If you're going to eat them, you don't have to treat them like a product. And if you're not going to eat them, then why are we doing all that stuff to them?
Right. Well said.
Melanie Joy, thank you so much for being with us today on The Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll see you next time right here on your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com and right here on your favorite radio stations, WTBF AM and FM. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.